All right, welcome back to this inaugural mailbag edition of Eastern Conference 15 and 60. We decided to go that route since there's not quite enough film or stats to draw many conclusions yet. If you missed Atlanta through Indiana, that was yesterday's program. You can go back and listen to that. Before we bring in Liam, though, to talk Miami Heat, I want to give you this from the Locked On Podcast Network that gives a fantastic treatment to all 30 NBA teams.
You must love hoops if you're enjoying another great episode of Dunked On. The Locked On Podcast Network has more hoops for you. Locked On has a podcast on every NBA team. If you're a Lakers fan, a Bucks fan, a Celtics fan, or a Mavericks fan, the Locked On Podcast Network has a daily podcast on your favorite team. All 30 NBA teams have a daily podcast at Locked On. Search on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Let's bring in Liam now to talk a little about the 1-2 Miami Heat. So what is our question about the Heat, Liam?
So the question about the Heat is, how would you handle their wing rotation and how would you handle it once Waiters returns, which we have no idea what the timetable is on that. So I'll handle the first part. The big breakout for the Heat, you know, in the early part of the season is Rodney Magruder has been really good so far. So I think you got to give him a lot of minutes. I don't know, like 30 or so is what I think for him and Richardson. Magruder so far, 16 points per game. 7 rebounds a game, 4 assists per game, 66 true shooting percentage, good defense. So I think he's a really quality wing that was injured most of last season. He can give them a lot of spacing from the perimeter as well as some defense. And Richardson is the guy they've invested in, obviously the talk of the Jimmy Butler trade. So he's going to need a lot of minutes. And after that, it gets a little bit dicey. Right now, Wayne Ellington's day-to-day with, I think it's an ankle injury. So he'll be back soon. I think he needs a lot of minutes. Wade, quite frankly, you know, with his defense slipping even another notch so far this season.
I saw you tweeted out, you know, you tweeted out some film of him just getting completely destroyed on back cuts.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I was going to mention it to you. I think he's probably a candidate. I don't know if you're going to do the all worst team defense this year article, but he's definitely he's going to be a candidate for that for sure. But what do you think about the wing rotation? They've got a couple other guys, but I'll talk about it.
I think a lot of it depends on where they're going to be this year as well. You know, I think, and it's difficult because so many of these guys are sort of one-dimensional. I mean, and I guess Magruder, you know, if he's going to shoot as well as he has, which he's not, but, you know, if he can become a quality shooter and he's a restricted free agent at the end of this year as well, and will have a minimum cap hold, although that won't matter, they'll be capped out. Richardson obviously is a big part of this team and his future, assuming he doesn't get moved in a potential Jimmy Butler deal, but he's got 4 more years left on his contract, or at least 3. He's got a player option on that last year that if he continues to be the same guy, you might opt out of. You know, Waiters, hard. He's got to be at the bottom of the pecking order. But again, they could really use his skill set, though, right? I mean, they don't really have anyone who can get to the basket. That's the same reason why Dwayne Wade is still probably more valuable on this team than any other team. Because again, you know, Dragic hasn't looked great in the early going so far, and he's really the one guy on this team who can do much off the dribble. Winslow, where does he fit in? Well, you know, they just extended him, so he's part of the future. Also, are you going to play him at the four? They also got James Johnson. Olynyk has been getting minutes at the four. So then you got 3 centers. If Olynyk's not going to play at the four as well, 3 centers who probably all deserve time, and Whiteside, Olynyk, and Bam, who they're also trying to develop. So I think a lot of it just depends on what the mission is and what the matchup is, right? And then, you know, they don't have any great shooters, so Ellington comes in there. They really need him, but he's probably the worst of those guys defensively other than Wade. So all of them bring something, but you really just can't play all of them. I mean, that's what was the impetus for the question, I'm sure. And then certainly as this team, if, you know, they look like they're kind of trending towards the 8th seed, or they even like potentially fall out of the playoffs, which is, you know, they're rough start. They've had a lot of guys injured, so maybe it's tough to say that that's going to continue. But, you know, then it becomes easy, right? We're going to play these young guys, and, you know, maybe we try to move some of these, the older guys who, you know, aren't on the shortest of contracts. But yeah, it's very difficult because a lot of these guys deserve time, but it's difficult to come up with like a good consolidation trade, because what they really need is to upgrade their talent. And that's why the Butler trade is so appealing. But if Minnesota is going to keep asking for the farm, then they can't do that either.
Yeah. And I've been generally generally opposed to the Butler trade just because I think that ties up a lot of their cap long term. And, you know, Miami is a team where they actually, their cap space is more valuable than most teams because they actually have the potential of luring a top free agent, and the back end of that Butler contract may not be so good for them. But, and you touched about
I guess just to finish up on Butler, I mean, I think it all just depends what your goal is as a franchise, right? I mean, now they're pretty much capped out to what, the summer of 2021? And yeah, I guess Butler, if they re-sign him, could end up being a bit of an albatross with the, those 5 years. We'll see how he looks by the end of this year. He had that great game the other night at home, but, you know, didn't look good in the first game. So we'll see how he's playing by the end of the year. But I think, you know, you make the move and just see what the team looks like with him there, right? You know, if you can get to 50 wins, that's worth keeping going for a couple of years, even if you're not a championship contender. Like, those wins aren't useless. But if you bring him in and, you know, you're still kind of the same team that you always were, then all right, you know, you took the chance and maybe you just don't offer him that contract, or you offer him a little bit less over the 5 years. But I think just where they're going right now is basically nowhere. So until 2021 anyway. So you might as well just like bring him in a higher end talent, see if you can make that consolidation trade. And the Wolves could, you know, could benefit from that because they have so little depth right now, you know, a Magruder, a Winslow, a Richardson, like those guys, an Ellington, like any of those guys could help the Wolves immensely. So this is kind of your really your chance to kind of do this, like, you know, five quarters for a dollar or, you know, something like that, or three quarters for a dollar, whatever you want to term it. So I would take the risk because it's like, you know, what's the downside? I think this is a better way to put it. Actually, I was talking to my my sister about this the other day, ironically enough, that the sometimes risk is always framed in terms of, okay, we have something here and it's risky to change up, right? But to me, the risk is almost more not doing it, right? Your risk is just being locked in to this team and really having no way to get out of it. And so, yeah, there's a chance that it wouldn't work, but there's really like not much downside to me to taking this risk because you don't have anything that's so great right now.
And that's definitely a fair point. They were, by point differential, a 42-win team. So then you got to ask yourself, how many wins does Butler give you? So, I mean, maybe that gets them up to 50. Maybe they make a couple internal improvements along with the team this year. But I guess my concern's more just the back part of it. And I understand what you're saying.
Like, yeah. They're not if it doesn't look like he's worth it, then you don't offer him the contract. You know what I mean? You take the risk and you just... Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like, okay, if we win 40 games this year and then we offer him that contract, that's when it really falls apart. But, I mean, they just don't have a path on this team to having an above average offense right now. I think that's their biggest problem.
No, and that's definitely, I mean, an issue, especially with some of the guys that they've given money to, where I feel like they feel like they're pressured to play Hassan Whiteside down the stretch. And I think, you know, maybe putting a Linick in some of those lineups would juice some of them offensively, but you're right. This team lacks some creators. Richardson is, you know, trying to develop some of it. And this season, he's taken 15 pull-up threes. Last season, he took 20 pull-up threes. So they're definitely giving the ball more to try and create more. And even in the Washington game, they gave him the ball down the stretch to create and pick and roll. And the problem was they kept Wade on the floor. So Wade would be, you know, in the corner three spot and they just collapsed on him and shut down anything. So I'd like to see what Richardson can do with a little bit more, you know, ball handling juice. It seems like he's developed a little bit of it. And, you know, I think a big key with it is, you know, he needs a spaced floor to do it. And that's why I think a lot of the lineups with Olynyk, you know, make a big difference. I looked at some of their lineups from last year and the difference in assist percentage with Olynyk on the court and off the court is massive. It's like 8 percentage points. It's the difference between like the third best assist percentage in the league and like the 27th. So I think it's really important for them to be able to move the ball a lot because, like you said, they don't have a lot of great on-ball creators. But I think with Spo, there is a chance for this offense to get up to, you know, close to like average with, you know, the shooters that they have, which I know isn't much to write home about, but it's at least, you know, there's some positives to take away from, you know, the early part of having Magruder and Richardson.
All right, so I'm going to put you on the spot here because we're past our 8 minutes, but since it's Liam, we're going to go slightly longer here. Put these guys in order of how much they should play, all those wing, those guys in the potential wing rotation. We didn't even really talk about Tyler Johnson much either, right? Like, he's another guy who's, he's really more of a wing, but plays point guard for them.
8 minutes isn't enough time to.
Well, yeah. So, all right. So put them in order. So Richardson plays the most, right? All right. Who's going to play the second most?
I've been a huge Magruder fan even before this season. And I think with what he's showed you so far,
wow,
I think
that's great. Based on three games or like that he's going to shoot this well?
Well, I was high on him before. Yeah. It's not even just the shooting. Like, he's passing much more than I thought he would. Like, he's played some pick and roll. He's had some nice lobs to Whiteside. Like, there haven't been many negatives to take away from those first three games. And, you know, as someone like me that had a lot of faith in him before the season, and I don't know who else, who would you have taken second?
Oh, Yeah, I mean, maybe when he's healthy, Ellington would certainly be up there. Right. I mean, like, exactly. I guess Magruder is really probably the only one of those guys, the only other one of those guys who's a two-way guy. So, yeah, I understand your point there. I'm just, if he continues to play at this level, I completely agree with you. I'm just not quite sold on that yet. And there are some other guys with big pedigrees here, too. And also, there's the component that, hey, you know, you might want to keep his price down and restricted free agency a little bit.
That's fair. But and you mentioned, like, Waiters is, like, exactly the type of guy they need, the type of, like, usage, get your own shot in ISO. But, I mean, I don't know if you saw the pictures of him coming into training camp. I think it's going to be a while before he's, you know, able to play minutes, and especially coming
He is a little more corpulent than he was a couple years ago, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's a generous way to say it. I want to be politically correct here, so I won't say more than that. But, yeah.
Okay, so Magruder, this is your show here. Magruder second, and then who would be third?
Well, for them, it's definitely going to be Wade, just because he's going to have those legacy minutes. But if you're just, like, best team on the floor, yeah, I think it'd be Ellington. I mean, he had a great shooting season last year, and he, like, if they're going to run a crunch time lineup out there, I think I'd want him out there if they're going to have Josh Richardson handling the ball, just because they can run on the weak side. They can have, like, a pin down for Ellington coming off. They can have, you know, multiple, you know, things going on in the play to distract the defense. And they're going to need that, because they don't have enough, you know, creation talent to just run a straight pick and roll every play, have three guys standing around and, you know, get a good shot off.
Yeah. So then, I mean, Waiters, I think we can kind of just leave him out of it until he's healthy at this point. And you're just going to kind of have Tyler Johnson be your backup one.
Yeah, that's where he's been playing. I mean, when he plays in those lineups with Wade, Wade's the primary ball handler anyway, but Johnson's guarding the point guard.
Yeah, and then what about Winslow? You're going to have him even behind all those guys? You know, that's tough too. They just signed the extension. I didn't expect to spend this long on this question, but it really is, like, quite difficult. And I mean, you got Derek Jones Jr. who's looked pretty good for them too. I mean, they got a lot of guys on this team.
And the roster construction is really, really strange. Like, Goran Dragic is the only, like, true point guard. They have six shooting guards, Richardson, Ellington, Magruder, Wade, Johnson, Waiters. And then they have three power. I view Winslow as more of a power forward. So they have James Johnson, Derek Jones Jr., and Justice Winslow power forward. And they have three centers that deserve, you know, rotation minutes with Whiteside, Olynyk, and Bam. So, yeah, I mean, this is probably the most interesting rotation to ask, like, who should play when, because there are so many, you know, different options that they could go through. So I think Winslow's on-off numbers were better last season when he played small forward, but I still view him as more of a power forward, especially with the lack of shooting that he has.
If you play him with Olynyk, I don't know. You know, maybe it looks a little bit better. If Olynyk is playing center, you can get away with him. But then, you know, James Johnson is kind of, he's like, you know, an average shooting power forward, maybe a little below average in this day and age.
And I didn't expect to you know, for this to be true, but I looked up last season and the lineups with Bam and Olynyk were actually pretty good. So maybe, you know, Bam plays some time at the four. I don't know who you'd consider the power forward out of the Olynyk Bam combo, but I mean, maybe they play. And then James Johnson had a pretty good season last year. So I feel like he'd be my first choice at power forward. So, and then, like you said, Derek Jones has had a pretty good couple games here that he might be starting to turn some of his potential into actual production. So, and he'll probably be third on the depth chart for power forwards, but they have a lot of guys that, you know, could play in a rotation on most teams, but, you know, none of that top end talent that you'd, you know, want to see on a good team. So I don't know. They're really interesting to me, even though they're not gonna.
And you got to be very careful with the combinations too, right? It's very easy to not get enough shooting or not get enough defense, and definitely not get enough creation, because all of these guys pretty much are limited, other than maybe Richardson, in one facet of that or another. All right, that was great. Let's move on right after this. Let's talk some about Masterclass. They just released a class from six-time World Series of Poker champ Daniel Negreanu. And yes, I actually know how to pronounce his name without the phonetic spelling. Thank you very much, Copy. I watched a little bit of World Series of Poker back during the poker boom a few years ago, and I wish that class would have been around, because quite frankly, I was always terrible at poker, and I stopped playing because I lost every single time. If I'd had this class, that wouldn't have been the case. If you're serious about poker, or if you just want to be the best player among your friends, you don't want to miss the secrets Negreanu shares in this class. In over 7 hours of high-quality video lessons, he teaches tournament strategy and gives you exclusive insights into the mental side of the game. And Daniel Negreanu's class isn't the only one at Masterclass. They now have over 30 classes, including one by Stephen Curry, which I really enjoyed. Great gift with the holiday season coming up for the basketball players in your life. They've got Bob Woodward on investigative journalism. They've got Annie Leibovitz on photography. They've got a number of great cooking classes as well. Whatever you're interested in, Masterclass has got a class for you. Today, listeners can unlock access to Daniel Negreanu's class as well as every single Masterclass for a year, now available at masterclass.com/capspace. You get unlimited access to over 35 world-class masters, not just 30, all for one surprisingly low annual price. Masterclass.com/capspace is that URL. Easy to remember, we talk about capspace all the time in the program. You get unlimited masterclasses at masterclass.com/capspace. Let them know with that /capspace URL that you came from us.
All right, always good to hear from Liam, but Danny is back now. Let's do some Milwaukee Bucks. Our question for them, what players should the Bucks target as Giannis's second banana that are realistic?
This is a way bigger challenge than I thought it was. And the reason why is because Milwaukee, partially because they paid Ersan Ilyasova, he got multiple years, and because those kind of around $10 million contracts don't expire. Even if Eric Bledsoe left, they still wouldn't really have functional cap space. So I think the answer is actually probably Chris Middleton. I think that's going to be really how this works out. And for me, the more likely avenue to get somebody better than Chris Middleton would be through a trade. And I guess, because in the summer, Brogdon's a free agent, so signing trades are always less likely to bring in a big fish. Maybe that would involve Thon. Maybe it would involve Dante DiVincenzo. But it's hard for them to get that high of end player. They can get better by getting deeper and getting quality players, but adding a second banana is tough.
The Bucks project at $18 million in cap space. That could grow to maybe 21 if they lose their pick, but they seem unlikely to, since it's protected 17 to 30. That's probably going to end up going in 2020. So, and that's without Middleton's cap hold, which will be $19 million. So that just wipes that out, just even to keep his cap hold on the books. And same thing with Bledsoe. His cap hold, $22 million. So, and then if you bring both of those guys back, just at what their cap hold would be, and Middleton's going to cost a lot more than that. We'll see about Bledsoe. But then they're right up against the tax already with that brilliant Ilyasova signing, who has helped quite a bit, and I'm sure will help them this year. But it probably is going to be Chris Middleton, and he is a good shooter. He's got some ISO ability as well. If they lost both Middleton and Bledsoe, and, you know, they still have Henson and Dellavedova on the books for a combined $20 million. So maybe they could just, you know, try to give up a pick or stretch those guys. And, you know, they could, so that could get them to, you know, call it maybe $35 million in space. What could be out there for $35 million in space, keeping in mind that they've now lost Middleton and lost Bledsoe? And oh, by the way, you also have to re-sign Malcolm Brogdon as well, although his cap hold is tiny and he's a restricted free agent. But, you know, is this team going to pay the luxury tax? Oh, of course they will, because they got publicly funded money for a stadium. They'll surely pay the luxury tax. Oh, wait, no, they're not going to. So I would suspect, if they have that $35 million, they got nothing at point guard. They have a desperate need for another shooter and creator on the wing as well. So who's out there? Oh, God. I mean, you know, Harrison Barnes, maybe, or, you know,
Kemba
would be interesting. It is a deep point guard market. A lot of it, so much of it really depends on, you know, it's really kind of feast or famine, too, because if things go well for them this year, let's say they have, like, you know, a second round exit in the game seven, or they even make it to the conference finals, which, you know, I don't think that's going to be possible. I don't think they could beat Boston or Toronto, as long as Toronto's healthy and Kawhi looking pretty solid so far. But, you know, if they get to the conference finals, then they're probably going to just pay whatever to bring everyone back. If they lose in the first round, and especially if they don't have a great regular season, they're looking great so far, but we'll see. Then it seems more likely that they wouldn't pay through the nose to bring all those guys back, and they might try to reset things, but then they're a less attractive destination as well, right? So, you know, their ability to lure free agents would be higher if they win more, but if they win more, they're more likely to just bring everyone back. And you know, because of the cap rules, you can bring back Middleton and Bledsoe, stay over the cap. You basically can only get one player probably who's the quality of those guys if you let them both go. So all of those things really seem to make a ton of sense. But what you fear is going to happen is they're going to pay Middleton a ton. They're going to pay Bledsoe a ton. And then, you know, if Giannis is ready to leave in a year because they're not actually contending for a championship, then, you know, you're stuck with those contracts are probably going to be bad because you made win-now moves. So they're really in a very difficult spot, despite the fact that they might be good this year. They got Bud. They're looking a lot better, but they need to be a lot, lot better. They need to be in the conference finals. And, you know, maybe at the end of the year, they'll have looked this good for so long and Toronto and Boston won't look as good, or Philly won't look as good, and we could actually say, hey, they might get to the conference finals. But if they're not really getting to the conference finals, like, it's hard to imagine Giannis is going to stick around and that they'll be a free agent destination. So it's really difficult. I mean, there are point guards out there, you know, you could try to get a Spencer Dinwiddie type and hope that you hit on him, or, you know, Goran Dragic as a player option, or Jeff Teague as a player option, or, you know, you mentioned Kemba as a possibility, though he'll have plenty of suitors, you would think. Don't think Jimmy Butler is going to be going there.
Well, oh, and something else worth noting here is, how does Giannis's posturing, publicly or privately, in terms of signing a designated veteran extension, factor in not only to the Bucks' decision-making, but also theoretical other free agents? Like, Kemba Walker, let's say, is probably not going to commit to signing with the Bucks if Giannis is on a one-year contract, functionally, because it's like, hey, I'm committing. If he has similar offers other places, they become less desirable because he knows that money is already on the table.
To be clear, Giannis would not be eligible to sign that extension until the 2020 off season, but next year is kind of the year that is going to determine whether he will sign that or not.
Yeah. Well, and I think there could be overtures that, you know, that kind of an idea maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, and surely
he can't actually
sign. And all he's got to do is make an All-NBA team this year, and then he will be eligible for that extension in the summer of 2020. Regardless, even if he doesn't play a single moment for next year, you know, same thing as Kawhi, basically. If you make it two out of the last 3 years, is all you have to do. So he made it last year. Seems damn good bet to make it this year. So I mean, and I think, you know, there are some who might say the designated player veteran extension has failed, and I think it's stupid. You know, I think you should just be able to pay everyone 35% whenever you want to. But, and that includes guys coming off of rookie contracts even. But you can at least say that part of the purpose that it serves is just bringing matters to a head. And hey, if we can't offer you this extension, or if we don't want to offer you this extension, we're just going to move you, you know. And so it gives teams clarity earlier on, which, you know, may not have been entirely an intended consequence of this, but I think it is something that actually has helped these teams, rather than just getting so deep into the process that you just, you know, you just lose the guy for nothing at the end. It's like, hey, Kawhi Leonard, we're not going to offer you this extension, so we got to trade you now, you know. All right, we got about a minute left here. You want to do another? How about this All-Stars question?
Sure. So the question is, will the Bucks have two or more All-Stars this year? I mean, they have one locked in Giannis, and there only being 12 spots makes it harder for Middleton to make it, especially if the Bucks are, let's say, the third or fourth ranked team in the Eastern Conference. So I'm going to say it's less likely that either Middleton or Bledsoe makes it, but it is certainly possible. And I think there's a distinct chance that Middleton deserves it and doesn't end up getting the spot.
We'll see. I mean, maybe if they are just killing it and they're on pace for like 55 wins and they're, you know, a top three seed as of the time it's selected, it could happen. But we went through it with Blake Griffin yesterday. I mean, there's a lot of competition these days, and so there he would really have to kind of get the narrative behind them. I always find these, oh, will he make the All-Star team questions less interesting, because I just, like, you could ask me whether he's deserved to make the All-Star team. I think it's probably not going to, but like having to do this, oh, will he, well, okay, so then you gotta think, how many games will they have won, and like, what's the narrative, and are the coaches sick of voting for all these other people, and what kind of people do the coaches usually vote for, and that's all, that's not very interesting to me compared to like actually analyzing who's a better player and deserves it. Let's talk about the Knicks.
We should start this with a little bit of news. Kevin Knox is going to be out for 2 to 4 weeks with a left ankle injury, which is certainly unfortunate, but he'll be back in plenty of time to evaluate everything else. And the Knicks are, this, that doesn't make this a lost season or anything like that. So it's unfortunate. We love to see him on the floor, but they have enough time.
Yeah, he'll be reevaluated in 1 week. But yeah, it didn't look like a great ankle sprain. And the initial diagnosis, of course, was the 2 to 4 week. Courtney Lee also yet to play. He's listed as not going to play tonight against Milwaukee, and still has this neck injury, which is really starts to get a little worrisome that it's been this long. That's one of those things that, like, it's hard to really get a timetable for. So the Knicks did completely destroy the Hawks the other night, but sorry, I completely distracted myself. We're doing the Knox or Neil Kinnick question.
We haven't even asked it yet, but that is the question we were going to do. So the question is, should Kevin Knox or Frank Ntilikina start? We'll presume when they're both healthy and everybody else is healthy.
Yeah, why the hell not? I mean, I think the only reason you wouldn't start Knox would be, well, so are we saying that it's a pick between those, or just like both of them could start potentially?
Well, I think you could ask it either way. I mean, should Knox or Frank start? I think the answer is both. And they, over the course of this season, the Knicks should, their main goal should be answering questions about their young guys.
And helping them develop.
You know, it's not winning. Yeah, and helping them develop. So figuring out whether Frank can be a primary ball handler or not, what position he defends best is important, what Knox's ideal role on both ends of the floor is. And so I would say starting both those guys, maybe not the whole year, but starting them a fair portion of the year would be the best for the purposes of evaluation, and especially starting them once they get Kristaps Porzingis back, if it happens at a moment in time where they can actually get a usable set of information.
Yeah, and maybe you could try to get Knox some minutes at the four as well. The argument against playing him at this point, because the Knicks are going nowhere this year, is just that, hey, you have to have playing time as a reward for getting them to do the little things that actually are going to impact winning. And, you know, Knox is not known for his ability to do that. He's more of a scorer. But you can still do that and start him anyway. I mean, and you might as well start him just for his trade value, right? He just racks up some counting stats. You see more of them. You know, the fans get more excited. He just gets a little more buzz. Like, yeah, go ahead and start him, I think. Also worth noting, by the way, remember how you... Do you want to just briefly reiterate why you thought the Hezonja signing was so ridiculous?
Yeah. So, best way to put this. They had the mid-level exception, and even though the Knicks knew they didn't want to put long-term money on their books, they could have given themselves functionality with that, maybe through a non-guaranteed season or a team option. They could have done either using the full mid-level exception. So, if Hezonja does well, all they have are non-bird rights, which would be enough to retain him, but he would have a big cap hold. And if he does poorly, then they get nothing for it anyway. So, you need to, when you're not going to be good, and we all knew they weren't going to be good, Porzingis was already out. Like, that was a known when the offseason started. You then use your exceptions to generate value, not for the present year, but for future years. And they absolutely failed at doing that.
Well, and now it's even more ridiculous because he's only played 42 minutes in the first three games, and that's with Knox getting hurt pretty early in that game against the Hawks. Or it might have actually been in the game against the Nets, excuse me. But so he's still not even getting out there. And this is with Lee injured and not playing. So he clearly is like in the doghouse and isn't getting any minutes. And it's just like, so he's not going to like apparently even play this year. He was always a flyer, but you know, he's behind the rotation for a guy who's even younger than him and presumably, you know, executes even worse because he's younger. And now Knox is injured. Maybe we'll see more of him now, but you know, Alonzo Trier is playing over him.
One other big part of this is, I don't think anybody thinks Mario Hezonja is underpaid, so you can't trade him as a value contract.
Yeah. I have not had a chance to watch a full Knicks game yet. Have you?
I haven't watched a full game yet. And so with Trier, saw some of him in Summer League, intrigued by his athleticism. And in preseason, I watched a fair amount of the Knicks. So I don't know yet what his ideal role is, though. It's been nice to see him pop a little bit, but I want to see more before I make a more definitive evaluation. That's something, if I had to ballpark it, I'd say I want about another month of information, but I'm looking forward to doing it.
Yeah. He has the name Iso Zode, known as a guy who has some moves, decent shooter and scorer, has some athleticism. So good guy for them to get at the back end of the roster. And you know, it was very highly touted, if a very old prospect for his age, coming out of Arizona, was on the Hoop Summit team a few years ago. So he was known as one of the big players in his class, although he was, again, you know, really more than a year older than a lot of the guys in his class. So he's definitely someone to watch, the exact kind of guy you want to take a chance on, though. At the end, we only had two Knicks questions. That's amazing. Should we just
maybe their fans are dispirited.
Can I just ask you a Knicks question?
Of course you can.
All right, we got like 2 minutes left here.
Okay.
How many games would you project Mitchell Robinson to start this season?
I'm going to go with 10 because I feel like Fizdale is going to push a little bit harder. And the other big problem is that depending on what happens with Porzingis, they have somebody else who plays. Maybe it'll be a little bit more than that. I'm still going to go with 10 though, because it'll be good to see him get his feet wet against backups, and you never know if he's going to be healthy or not. So the pivot will happen probably before that. It should happen pretty early, but that's my guess is 10.
Yeah, on Saturday against the Celtics, Robinson actually played some minutes next to Enes Kanter, but they also have no fours on this team, and not really many threes with Knox out as well, and he was struggled with that ankle injury that he suffered in the preseason. Noah Vonleh has also been playing a fair amount. That's annoying that Vonleh would play over Robinson, but it's early, and Fizdale you know, this is kind of the same question as with Knucks. He's especially coming in as a new coach this year. You're trying to set a tone for what you expect from this team, and you know that defense and working hard and little plays and all that stuff is going to be what gets you time. And so, you know, he kind of can't really just start a guy in Robinson who just probably doesn't really know what he's doing, even if Robinson kind of might be more effective ultimately than Vonleh. That doesn't really just send the right message to the team that, you know, you can just waltz in here and start basically without, you know, knowing the concepts as well, even if he's making up for it in other areas. You see, and I don't know that I even agree with this, but I think that's kind of the thought is, number one, the coaches probably equate making mistakes to losing maybe more than they actually should sometimes. Because it just obscures all the good things that player can do. And Robinson, you know, is kind of one of those guys. I'm not saying he's like some great winning player right now, but just that coaches fixate on mistakes and correlate that with losing more so than, you know, maybe someone who's a little bit more neutral, because it just kills them when, you know, guys don't execute the system. But also, I think they're, yeah.
Can I make, sorry,
please.
Can I make kind of a bridging point with this and the next team we're going to talk about, where like these centers who are better than some of the options that are available for these teams that are expiring contracts and not going to probably be a part of their future. It's just like, what's going to happen with these guys? Because like, I don't see any team saying we need Enes Kanter. So like, is Enes Kanter going to get bought out? I'm really interested in how this turns out.
Yeah. Vucevic is another one too. But yeah, just to finish my point there though, I think that when you're trying to set the culture, especially early in the season, it's just like the idea that mistakes won't be tolerated, I think, you know, kind of takes on an outsized importance. We'll see what happens to Robinson. I imagine by the end of the year, he'll be playing over Noah Vonleh, who's, you know, again, on a one-year deal and not a guy that I hate as a player. I think he was a good flyer, but again, you know, not a guy who has any upside in terms of like a non-guarantee or you know, anything that you talked about. Let's talk a little Orlando Magic here.
So the primary question here is, how do you see the big man rotation shaking out, and what are your favorite big man combinations for the Magic?
Do I have to pick one?
Well, I'll start. So I see it shaking out. My instinct is, especially with Steve Clifford, again, a new head coach trying to set a tone, I'm guessing ownership has expectations for this season that we'll see more Vooch, especially early in the season. I actively dislike playing either, however you want to define terms, either Gordon or Isaac at the three, just because they have such a big need for offense. So that's a place to start here.
Yeah, I mean, to me, Isaac at the five and Gordon at the four is still sort of what I want to see the most. Just for my own aesthetics, no Nikola Vucevic. I mean, he is just, there are a few players that I dislike watching more in the league at this point. A guy who just has an outsized idea of his own importance, like despite the fact that he's worked hard to add a three-pointer to his game, I'll give him credit for that, but just never gets to the foul line, wants the ball all the time, either to either make passes or post up, takes still some pretty bad shots, and is just an absolute complete post on defense. And so I really just don't like watching him at all. I mean, just any pick and roll ball handler on the other team just, you know, can waltz into an open jumper, or if he makes a couple of jumpers, then just blow by Vooch for a layup. So take him out of there for me. He's not part of the future of this team. He's an expiring contract. So I think really, you know, Bamba and Gordon, you know, they're starting Isaac, Gordon, and Vooch together. Don't really care for that one. So I think it would be Isaac at center. I'd want to see that lineup really try to switch, put pressure on. Their other problem is that they don't have any kind of size at point guard. So yeah, you can switch with your four and your five, but if you can't switch with your one, it gets a little harder. But there's ways to avoid that. If you only have one guy that you can't have in that matchup, you can switch him out more easily.
So Grant's 6'5", but I don't think of him as a particularly big 6'5".
No, he's not 6'5". He's like 6'2".
Oh, interesting. Okay, he's listed
at 6'5". Is he really listed at 6'5"? That can't be right.
I don't think of him as being that tall.
I'm going to look that up right now while you talk about the next question that we have for them.
Well, actually, I'll answer a little bit more on this one briefly. My favorite combination is Gordon and Isaac, just because I want to see what Isaac does at the 5. And I would really like to see all three combinations. And when you have 48 minutes at two big man positions, they could be giving each of these guys around 30 minutes. I'd have Gordon above that line. It's 32 is the split, but I would have Gordon, you know, more mid 30s, have Bamba mid 20s, and then give a couple extra minutes to somebody else. But I like all three combinations. I want to see all three without playing all three of them together. Just any, you know, Gordon, Isaac, Bamba, Gordon, Bamba. I'm good with all of them.
Huh. Jerry and Grant, 6'4" in shoes. 8'4 standing reach. Yeah, he doesn't play too big, but yeah, and 6'8 wingspan. All right, it's bigger than I thought. It's more, you see him out there and he looks like just the same size as all the rest of these dudes at point guard. Can the Magic defense be good this year under Steve Clifford? And we got about 2 minutes and 30 seconds left here. So I don't think it's possible to be good on defense with Vucevic having a large role. That appears to be the case right now. Bamba is still a rookie. He has had some moments, obviously, blocking shots early in games. Gordon and Isaac still a little bit more potential. Isaac, you know, has still had some good moments. They can put some okay defensive units out there. You know, I see them when Vooch is out there, you know, they're probably a bottom 20 unit. I could see them maybe getting the average with their length, if not their defensive intelligence and execution. But good is, that's probably pushing it this year. I mean, a good defense to me is top 10. So no, I don't see them sniffing that. A
couple other challenges for them. One, their offense is going to be bad. And so that means a higher proportion of their defensive possessions are going to be in transition. And it's harder to defend in transition than in the half court. And also, I expect this team to foul a bunch. And so that's just going to go against them. And I know that's not a hallmark of Steve Clifford teams, but it is a hallmark of young big men. So I expect it to be where they end up.
Yeah. And actually, it's kind of interesting. I think deep teams, which this team has a lot of guys that they're going to play, even if they're not all that great, some of them. But I think deep teams actually like tend to foul a little bit more because, you know, guy, if you only know you're playing 20 minutes, it's like, you know, the biggest deterrent effect of fouling isn't necessarily, oh, darn, I just gave up 2 free throws for my team. It's, oh, I don't get to play anymore. So if that's less of a deterrent, then you're going to foul a little bit more. I'd actually be curious to see if that could empirically be tested. It's something that seems intuitively true, but I'm not sure if it actually is true. Last quick question here, 30 seconds. Could Vucevic return an asset now that he's expiring?
If they're willing to take on bad money, but not in and of himself.
Yeah. And even then, you know, someone like Simmons or Fournier or Ross would probably be much higher on the list of players. I really just don't think Vucevic helps a good team at all at this point in the playoffs. Like, he's just too easy to attack. You know what I mean? And he's not nearly as good offensively as like someone like Enes Kanter. And even Kanter couldn't get on the floor against most playoff teams. All right, Philly, what adjustments.
Are you shocked that we have a bunch of questions for them?
Yeah, we do. But I really like this one a lot, especially because they just played them. What adjustments does Philly need to make to beat the Celtics? And it's tough because so much of it is just personnel. I mean, I think, you know, I would still like to see Ben Simmons used more in a pick and roll. You know, give them just a little bit more diversity to their offense. I know that Brett Brown doesn't really care for pick and roll as much. That he's proud of the fact that they generally are pretty low in the league in terms of the number of possessions finished by the pick and roll ball handler. But pick and roll is also one of the hardest things to stop when the other team can really lock in on some of the other stuff that you're doing. I'm not with this personnel. It seems really difficult, right? I mean, it's really what it has to come down to is just the individuals on this team have to play better or just be different players, essentially, right? Like Robert Covington last year in the playoffs, you know, he's a solid individual defender and like, all right, he's not like a lockdown artist. You know, he's a little thin, doesn't have the most amazing lateral quickness. He's an excellent off-ball player, but he was just getting blown by last year, and like his footwork on closeouts was terrible. He was just getting torched, like straight line drives in isos, like not even getting a hand up on jumpers. Like, so he's just got to play better, you know, like that's one. Joel Embiid, you know, it's a tough ask for him to post up and score against Al Horford, who plays him extremely well, but he's just gonna have to do that. Like, that's and Embiid has looked unbelievable in the two games that he's played not against the Celtics. You know, I think he's got 30 in both those games on very efficient shooting. You know, Dario Saric has to shoot the ball better. You know, I don't know if he could be much better defensively than he's shown. Ben Simmons, you know, he's got to find a way to score in the half court a little bit better and, you know, attack switches himself and maybe run some pick and roll. But other than just simply running more pick and roll, and I thought they tried some things, like they tried switching more in that first game to just kind of see how that looked. And, you know, they had a few times where Joel Embiid was guarding Jason Tatum that didn't go amazingly well. But the Celtics can kind of be baited into some difficult shots. They have a lot of one-on-one creators, but if you're not giving up three-pointers to them, you're giving up mid-range twos, you know, that's probably a win against their offense. But, you know, I don't see a ton strategy-wise that I can point to. I mean, they're trying stuff. They deserve credit for that, right? Like, they tried way more post-ups, and they just, you know, they couldn't get the ball in. They turned it over, and then they just weren't efficient. But they tried to use the advantages that they theoretically have. But to make good on those advantages, the players who possess those advantages have to actually take advantage of them. And maybe those advantages don't really exist, but That's what it comes down to, is those guys just got to play better. And then, you know, there's also, other than that, there's things like hope Markelle Fultz develops and,
I'm terrified that you're going to give my answer
here. All right. Sorry.
So part of why I like this question is, while I agree with everything you said, my answer is actually different than that and its other points. So one thing that's exceedingly important against the Celtics is you have to play guys that the other team has to defend, because they're so good at helping and knowing how much functional space. We saw this against Markelle Fultz. We also saw this with the Celtics when they played against Toronto. Pascal Siakam was gumming up the works a lot for the Raptors because they were just helping off of him. So that's one thing, is maximize your rotation. And so that means probably more Redick, less Fultz, and a few other elements. Something else that I would like to see them do is exploit Boston's not necessarily zero resistance switches, but their less resistance switches, and use the shot clock. So basically try to get Kyrie Irving on somebody where you don't want Kyrie Irving, and that Ben Simmons is perfect for that. Just get him somewhere, maybe try to get him in foul trouble, and so I would actually do some plays where I have whoever Kyrie's guarding set the screen for Ben Simmons and see if you can force that
early in the possession,
say in the first,
right? Because
in the first 6 seconds of the shot clock.
And their problem is that I totally agree with that, and that's, I mean, they've tried plays like that a little bit, but their problem is a lot of times, they get the switch and then they try to get the ball into the post, and Boston is just so good at communicating and switching behind the play that the mismatch is gone, or, they're pressuring up and you can't get in. So I love the idea of, similar to LeBron James, now Simmons is going to struggle because he can't shoot a jump shot the way LeBron James can. But if he's got a small guy in him, you just get that switch or force a double team at the point of attack, do that as your first action on every play and then run your play, or do that and then clear out. But then you run into the issue of, they have Fultz on the floor, you don't have to guard him. They've got too many guys that you don't have to guard. But I think that's letting Simmons just, dribble into a post-up against a real small player is something that they really should do more of, to be sure.
Yeah, and another model for this, LeBron is a great one to bring up, but also what the Clippers did before everybody got hurt against the Blazers in that series a few years ago, where they were just basically treating it as the beginning of their set was getting the matchup they wanted and doing it as, doing it quickly. You can do that, and I think the Sixers need to realize that getting through everything in their arsenal. I want to do this one quickly. Should the Sixers pursue Jimmy Butler? My answer is no at any reasonable asset price. If the asking price goes down,
this won't be what Tibbs wants, but maybe if they start off so poorly that he just loses his, but that 2021 Miami pick as the centerpiece. That's reasonable, right?
Well, yeah, if it gets that low, that's kind of what I'm talking about. Well, the downside with Sharish, because with Jimmy Butler, I think that he overlaps a little bit too much with Simmons, because Jimmy likes having the ball in his hands. So in an ideal world, that pairing would work, but I don't think in actuality it would. And he's a little bit too old for me for their core. So yeah, they're really good now. I worry a little bit.
But there's
about
no way they're going to trade Simmons or Embiid to me. So everything else to me is pretty fungible. I mean, now maybe Covington I wouldn't want to give up, although again, how good was he going to be?
Well, yeah, but
playoffs?
I'd be giving those up for somebody who's not a free agent next year and who's
that's the question. And who's available that they can outbid the Celtics for? This is kind of the point I made with Liam when we talked, which you weren't here for, about Miami, is you could say, yeah, we're not going to give up that much for Jimmy Butler, but who else are you getting? And Butler, yeah, I mean, I guess you trade for him, and then in theory, he's got a pretty big cap hold, so he eats into $10 million of your cap space, but you could still probably find a way to do some more stuff in free agency and bring him back as well if you wanted to. But it's kind of Dario Saric, guess what, Dario Saric is not putting Philly over the top for a championship. If you could give up Dario Saric and that 2021 Miami pick, I just don't see who else you're getting that's gonna make this huge difference, who's gonna be available in the next couple of years that's better than Butler. If you can get a guy like that, do it now, see how it works, and if it doesn't, I guess he's going to leave. But I think you also have concerns about his personality meshing with Simmons and Embiid, and people have talked about how those guys, what they're like personality wise and then you throw Fultz into the mix as well. I mean, that's another question, Fultz, would you put him on the table for a Butler trade
if he looks the way he's looked for the last little while? I would consider
As of right now, you got to just project.
I wouldn't because I just don't think the present value of Jimmy Butler is as high.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. It's probably more likely than not to fail. But, a lot of things are more likely than not to fail. And you still have to take the chance. Jimmy Butler is a hell of a talent.
And the hilarious thing here in certain ways is that I would have been much more comfortable going hard after Kawhi. But if the Spurs, as it has been reporting, happened, that they said Simmons and Embiid are no deal, if that was really true, then it's crap. They're just subject to a team that put a too high price tag on it.
Yeah, I mean, mean, but if it turns out, and maybe the Spurs just wouldn't have done this, but, you know, Philly's like, oh, we'll never put Marco Fultz in the deal. If it turns out that, like, they could have had Kawhi, and Kawhi looks pretty damn good so far, by the way. I don't know if you noticed, but if it turns out they could have had Kawhi if they put Fultz in the deal and they didn't do it, you know, I think that's probably something that they'll end up seeing as a mistake, especially because, you know, by not getting him, you created a really good team in Toronto that is probably better than you now, too. But who knows? So many unknowns there. Maybe Fultz will come through. I'm quite skeptical. All right, that's probably good for them. Let's talk a little Toronto Raptors here right after we tell you about SeatGeek. Certainly, we would love for you to watch the Twitter NBA show. We did it for that awesome Boston-Toronto game on Friday. I still can't stop going on about how much I enjoyed that game. But wouldn't it even be even better to just be in the building? And SeatGeek, when you're buying tickets, whether it's for sports, concerts, comedy, whatever you want to do, they've got you covered by searching multiple ticket sites, and then they grade every ticket based on value. So it saves you time and money, because you've got all the tickets in front of you. You don't have to search a bunch of multiple ticket sites on your own. And then you just look for that big green dot in the area you want to sit and trust that that's the best value ticket that's available. And you saved yourself a ton of time. If you haven't, for some reason, tried SeatGeek yet, use that cap space code. Easy to remember. We talk about it all the time on the program. And you get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app, enter promo code CAPSPACE, and you'll get that $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event. We have the tickets. And don't forget that cap space code. Let them know that you came from us. All right, starting with the Toronto Raptors. Now 3-0 after a heroic San Kawhi Leonard win against the Wizards, who we'll talk about after this. What is the best closing lineup for the Toronto Raptors against the Boston Celtics, Danny?
The non-negotiables are really actually not that many numerous. So Kawhi and Kyle Lowry, I would say, are in that conversation. Then the next tier for me would be OG Anunoby and Danny Green. And the reason why is Danny Green, he looked very good in that game on Friday.
Yeah, he looked fantastic.
So his defense is valuable. He's comfortable shoot. You know, the role that you're asking of Danny Green in this Toronto idea against the Celtics is actually pretty similar to what he did in certain moments of his time against the Spurs. Maybe the defensive scheme is a little bit different, but not too far off. And then OG, because he can defend players at a lot of different positions. Again, a low usage guy. And that last spot, you could go in a lot of different directions. Could go with a big like Pascal Siakam or Serge Ibaka or JV, or he could go with a small like Fred VanVleet. And I end up more on the side of going with somebody like Siakam. I mean, he didn't, the Celtics exploited his ball handling and all that, so he would need to reach a level where I felt a little bit more comfortable that either he's not going to make those mistakes because he's better, or he's not going to make those mistakes because you tell him you can't do it. But his versatility, being more of a switch guy, is important. So I would have Siakam in that last spot ranked probably tentative one now, Ibaka two, just because Ibaka's less defensively versatile, though I think he's obviously a better player right now. He looked good on Friday as well. Then probably FVV, because I don't think you need his creation as much, and he's not as versatile defensively. Then probably Valanciunas, unless I'm missing somebody. I think DeLon Wright is not in this either, just because of his size.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think it's quite possible that their bigger problem against the Celtics is going to be offense rather than defense. So maybe it would be VanVleet. And now, if Anunoby, and I think Danny Green absolutely has to be out there, because they just need one more knockdown shooter out there. You know, OG, certainly Siakam are limited shooters. And it looks like, you know, they're going to try and get the ball to Kawhi Leonard. And, you know, they need a little bit more shooting around there. I mean, I think Ibaka, I thought, was outstanding against the Celtics. Shot the ball really well. I mean, he's probably, Ibaka, you know, among their 3 through 5s, other than Leonard, the best shooter. So I certainly, you know, a lot of it depends on how well they're playing, but I thought Ibaka moved pretty well. You know, when you get Ibaka and OG and then maybe Siakam out there, like, you start to run into some decision-making problems. But, you know, I think, and VanVleet is a very tenacious defender. And also remember this too. This is something that I think is going to start to be a little bit more noticeable, is if you are switching, they can only go at one guy one-on-one, right? You know, so it's kind of like, and presumably that'd be Lowry, and Van Vliet's kind of about the same as Lowry. So it's like, you know, who your second worst defender is doesn't really matter as much. And so having Van Vliet out there, and I do think it's nice to have maybe one more ball handler. We'll see too how good Kawhi looks as a ball handler. Nick Nurse was talking about really wanting to get Kawhi's pick and roll game going a little bit more. I think that's going to be important for him. Kawhi never, I think, like, the most assists he's ever averaged has been like 3, which is incredibly low for a perimeter player with the type of usage that he's ramped up to here.
So I think I probably would go Van Vliet at this point, because I think that just scoring and also being able to get out in transition is really important for this team too. And so that gives you another guy who can push the pace. Generally, you know, he's very experienced at doing that now with the way they played in the second unit. Wright might be another one I would even look at too. You know, we'd see how he'd hold up defensively as well. I like Van Vliet more as a shooter off the ball than Wright. So I think he would be my guy. I think he's and you know, Siakam at the five could be interesting, because then you can switch some as well. You know, you're not probably going to do that. You know, Ibaka against Kyrie Irving is not great. You know, that's the guy that you're having to defend on the other end. I did want to do a little bit of a rant about Siakam, though. I did this on the Twitter NBA show, but Siakam has Mason Plumlee disease right now. And, you know, he's not going to look as good against the Celtics. They're a great defensive team. But he's one of these guys who, you know, started off as a really unskilled player. And so it seems like he and maybe even the organization are very proud of like how he's been able to increase his skill level. And so now, though, he's like trying to show off the skill level all the time as a grab and go guy. He had like a couple of turnovers there. He had a couple of really like head down kind of drives into traffic that just didn't really look very good. And so I felt like he's got the skill level. It's like, oh, I'm going to show this off now. But like, yeah, your skill level is a lot better than it used to be. But really, like, compared to a lot of guys, it's like not really that great. You know, he can't make a three still. You know, his like when a small guard comes around him and really tries to pressure him, as the Celtics did, like his handle is not tight enough to actually like not dribble defensively and not lose the ball. So it's just like, it's one of these things where it's like, oh yeah, look at all this growth from him. Like, we're so excited. And I think it's just like a little bit overrated, and he's just like trying to do too much now, as opposed to just like, yeah, you know what? Hey, when they throw it to me and I'm open, I can now take a couple of dribbles and get to the rim, as opposed to, oh, I'm going to really push the ball down these guys' throats. Like, yeah, this is the Celtics. Like, Marcus Smart is going to take your shit, Pascal.
Yeah, his exuberance is usually a strength, but at certain moments, exuberance could be a weakness. JaVale McGee is another good example of this at moments in time where it's just like, I can do this, I'm going to do it. And then, and like, Siakam had that one awful spin move in the Celtics game where it's like, well, that's the right thing to do. And it was just an easy steal for Boston. So yeah, that could be very problematic for them. Do we have any time left?
Yeah, we got about a minute here. Do a couple of real quick hitters. Is OG's best position small forward or power forward? I think we'd both agree it is power forward. Just not quite good enough offensively yet at small forward.
Yeah, well, defensively, I like him. I like him defending, yes, threes. Like, I was really impressed with what he did to LeBron. And I define a guy's position as who you defend. So if we want to draw that nuance, it's there. But offensively, you need a guy who's a better forward than him as other guy. So if you want to think of that as
I disagree with you now, because it's just there's a lot of guys who can defend the three but just can't hold up there offensively anymore. You know, your Justice Winslows, I'd say OG is kind of in that category as well, unless you have some more space. His three ball looks a little bit better this year. His decision making is not great still. You know, we'll see how the year evolves. Maybe he's taken some steps forward, but I still think power forward, especially because, you know, they got this guy Kawhi Leonard on the team. Should anything less than a finals appearance be considered a failure for this team this year? Yeah, you know, I think so, unless you know, there's some injury concern where they just couldn't have gotten there. But I mean, you probably got to get to the finals to have a chance to retain Kawhi Leonard. So yeah, that's the goal. And that Masai Ujiri has been very, and even their local broadcast team was very clear that like that's got to be the goal this year. So yeah,
I would say it's a disappointment but not a failure, just because I don't think they're necessarily the best team in the conference, so it's hard for me to say that it would be a failure, but it would certainly be pretty disappointing.
Well, I mean, wasn't it a failure for Houston and not get to the finals last year? I mean, I just in terms of their internal goal, you know, it could still be a failure. Like, I don't think anyone in the organization would be like, oh, I feel really good about the season we had, if they don't make it to the final. That's kind of what I judge that by. Wizards here. You wanted to discuss Scott Brooks, his quote about Otto Porter.
Yeah. So after their loss to the Kawhi-less Raptors, Scott Brooks was not pleased. And from Fred Katz wrote a really nice piece for The Athletic, theathletic.com/capspace, that as somebody who did not watch that game, it colored in between the lines, because I kind of felt like something had gone on there. And so the first big quote was, he was asked, because Otto Porter didn't play a ton in that game, and he said, I want guys to play hard. We got to play hard. You don't need extra minutes to play hard. Got to play hard, everybody. And that's a pretty strong indictment of somebody who's making a ton of money for your team. Somebody who, while they have other forwards,
specifically about Otto Porter in that quote.
It seems to me, yes, that was as I interpreted Fred's piece. That was my read of it. Yes.
Yeah, and then a lot of people have been talking about the number of three pointers that Porter attempted, and that's been, since he's been become a more accurate shooter, it's been a hope that he could become a little bit more versatile with those jump shots from downtown.
But also, like, the Wizards' defense has really sucked. I mean, we talked about their failures on the glass in that loss against Miami. I mean, the other thing, too, is, like, you know, they just had two close losses. And, yeah, they were at home, but, you know, two close losses against playoff teams, like, in games that kind of could have gone either way. Now, granted, Kawhi Leonard didn't play in that Toronto game, which I think is, you know, that's always something that's going to put you on the hot seat, is, like, if you lose a game to a team without its best player. But, you know, the two losses at home to playoff teams, I mean, I'm not hitting the panic button yet for these guys.
Well, I will note it's two losses at home to playoff teams who were both on the tail end of back-to-backs.
Yeah, that's fair.
That makes it a little bit worse. So I went back and reread that section of Fred's piece, and it was directly about asking why Otto Porter played 25 minutes. So yeah. It was an indictment of Otto Porter. He also said that Porter not taking any threes in a game, or that was not acceptable. There could be reasons. Again, I didn't watch that game specifically.
Yeah,
but
I don't know that that's an indictment of Porter. It could just be, hey,
we just aren't
doing a good enough job overall.
Right. But that leads sort of into the primary question of this, which is, how should the Wizards be looking to change their roster in season? And Washington has these big behemoth contracts, which make it hard for them to do a lot. I mean, they already moved Jody Meeks to reduce their luxury tax bill, and they're still over the tax by, I have it as $7.7 million over, and they're not going to get all the way under realistically. There isn't a clear-cut way to do that. I actually don't see them really, like, doing much on this roster. Their perimeter depth is pretty good. They have been hurt on the interior depth by Dwight Howard missing this time, but there isn't, I mean, other than maybe getting a better guy for the minimum, somebody who they trust or something like that, there isn't really a lot that they can do there. Also, the Wizards, their assets are kind of the things that they're going to need on the margins to keep this team at least somewhat cost stable over the next couple of years. So, I mean, I'd be listening on Otto Porter. I'd be listening on Bradley Beal. I would, of course, be listening on John Wall, because I think his contract is real bad. And you see if anything comes out there. But I mean, I guess, would you say that the easiest way to move this roster would be talking to somebody about Markieff or about Kelly Oubre?
Oh, man. I don't know. It's, I mean, Oubre, they did not come to an extension with him, so it'd have to be someone who is interested in Oubre as a restricted free agent. He's a tough guy to peg in terms of what his market value is, so that's going to be difficult. You know, Oubre hasn't really shown a ton. He's shown some development, but, you know, not enough to where, hey, we're going to bring this guy in to be our starter. You know, those are the tough guys to peg in restricted free agency. And, you know, Markieff, his star has kind of fallen. I mean, I guess he's like an okay starter at power forward, but probably really a below average one at this point, but he makes, you know, below average starter money too. So yeah, it's very difficult. We also had the question of, does John Wall pass the Nene test? You think it's very simple. I actually don't think it is. I think it's possible that they could trade him and not have to, like, and actually even maybe get something back. Like, you're telling me that the Suns wouldn't just take him? Like, if he just, you know, plays okay and doesn't get hurt this year, like, the Suns wouldn't just take him? Especially because, like, they...
Well, so there's a difference with the Nene test. I think of the Nene test in the abstract, which is not any single team. And so it's the overall thing. He does not necessarily... Well, he actually, in my opinion, does fail it for every team, but my evaluation is probably different than them. So, yeah.
Well, we thought that
so
about
all on the
Clarkson
same page
too, and nope, there was one,
right, and that's exactly what I want to get to. So John Wall, after this season, he will be that is when the designated veteran contract kicks in. So this is actually, we don't know the exact value because we don't know exactly where the cap's going to be. I have the number at 4 years, 170.9 million, so that's more than 40 million a season, which is rough, and that's a lot of money. He has looked better physically this year, which is very encouraging, and I'm happy about that for a lot of different reasons, but that is so much money to commit. And the Suns, with, they don't have a massive amount of other obligations. I mean, they have TJ Warren, who's getting paid there, but you have to be so sure that he's your guy, because if it's not, then you're basically sitting on that for 4 years and you can't do anything.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't make that trade, but I think there are multiple teams that would trade for him and would even give up something to do it, especially because this year he's not making that much. So you can actually, like,
yeah, that's
get him in there, and the salary matching is a loser. And a team like the Suns, it's like...
Well, and even...
Like the Suns have $20 million in space next summer, right? So you kind of think of it as like, okay, we trade for John Wall now, and would we rather have John Wall next summer, or would we rather have whoever we can get for $20 million in space? It's kind of like, it's easy to talk yourself into it, even if, you know, perhaps it wouldn't be. And especially a team like the Suns, it's like, oh, maybe they could even like start to think about the playoffs if they got John Wall and they've been mired in the metaphorical desert for so long. But what were you going to say?
I was going to say that the other example you brought up, Jordan Clarkson, which is a fair one to do, is Blake Griffin. I mean, we thought that Blake Griffin was a bad contract, another player who was paid more for past success than expected value on his next deal, and a desperate team traded for him in the first year of that contract.
Yeah, and Kevin Love could end up falling into that category too. Who knows? We can finish up here with the Dwight Howard situation has officially grown quite concerning. There was talk even that he could be back at the start of the regular season with that piriformis. With my wife being a yoga teacher, I'm well familiar with that muscle. Is a butt muscle, but all that's connected obviously with the lower back, and he's had these surgeries. And so, you know, it's all related to some of the issues. I mean, I love the, oh yeah, but this is an unrelated back injury to his other injury. Like that's always, I don't think that really actually exists. We are out of time, but this is the last one, so we can continue here. But just to finish up, he will not be traveling with the Wizards on a 5-game road trip. And perhaps that's maybe a little bit more why there's this feeling of doom with the team to have lost 2 home games. And now you're going on a 5-game road trip right at the start of the year. So he's not traveling with the team. Maybe he could rejoin them. Maybe he's just staying there for surgery. Flying on planes isn't great for your back, but that signing is not looking good. And we can close on this question. Will Dwight Howard opt in to his player option for next year?
I think he will. There,
in other words, not, can I start using the voice with his? No.
I don't think you could start using the voice yet. No, this isn't like Ron Baker or Enes Kanter. Now, if he misses months, if we start to get into that range, then maybe the voice. But
yeah,
that's true. I'm trying to think of what I'm sure there are some voice ones. At some point, that could be like a Patreon mailbag question or something. Would be who gets the voice for this year?
Oh, yeah. But then would I have to just do the voice like 20 for 25 times for each?
Maybe it's just previewing.
Maybe we can just like make it a feature, like a periodic feature. Is like you at the end of the episode, like you can just lob me one and like I can decide.
Okay.
This is turning
not
into
start
like
it now,
that,
though.
Turning into like that Seinfeld where he like starts dating that woman and like gives her stomach like a little voice. It's like starting to get to that level.
Yeah. But people like it, so I guess it's okay. I don't think from what I recall, people didn't like it in the Seinfeld episode.
Well, it was catching to the people who were doing it, and maybe that's the only thing the only thing that matters. So, well, the person being described with the voice, or who's I think it was like,
yeah. Oh, I have an exercise we can do.
Oh yeah,
let's just go. Let's say Dwight Howard misses this entire road trip. I'm gonna go through the 5 teams and let's think about how they're gonna do. Portland, Golden State, Sac, LA, and Memphis. And LA is the Clippers. Sorry, I should clarify.
I think like 2 and 3 they would have to feel pretty good about. So that's now they're 2 and 5. The end of that, and I think, you know, I'm not sure whether 1 and 4 or 2 and 3 is more likely on that trip, but you know, they'll be significant underdogs in 3 of the games. And you know, a team like the Wizards on the road in the West, you know, it's really against just about anyone, it's hard to make them a favorite, a huge favorite. You know, and Sacramento can be tough at home, and you know, Sacramento just beat OKC in OKC with Russell Westbrook playing really well tonight. So, I screwed up. This is airing on Monday. I'd done such a good job of pretending like it was tomorrow until just now. But that means it's time to end this. Thank you so much for listening. Anything you wanted to talk about before we depart here?
Well, so it came out over the weekend, but you can listen to the podcast I did with Sam Vecenie of The Athletic on some of the 2019 draft prospects, but also the G League policy change, because he wrote a piece on that. So we talked
excellent
about
piece.
The impact.
Available at theathletic.com/capspace, by the way. Sam, he like did a ton of reporting, talked to people in college and the pros, and he wrote, I don't know, it was probably like a 3,000 word piece, which was awesome. I'm only about halfway through it, but I mean, that's the sort of awesome like long form stuff you're getting on The Athletic at theathletic.com.
right. And he that was actually, we actually delayed the podcast because he was writing that piece, and I'm like, yeah, totally fine, get your work done. And so that was good, and we talked about player development and all that. It's like a 2-hour podcast, so people can listen to that. Also, at some point in the next couple days, I'm going to try to have out the first new piece of this big series I'm going to do for The Athletic on previewing free agency in 2019. And so I went through all of the max players and kind of gave a little bit of the breakdown of it and what I think might happen with them. Not predicting teams, but more to the general circumstances. So like writing about Klay Thompson's free agency in particular was something I found interesting because like it hasn't been talked about as much. So, you know, like Jimmy and KD and all those type of guys, that's been discussed ad nauseum, and it's going to be even more nauseating after that. But yeah, so that's coming out in Warriors Work, and whatever else I want to write, it's probably going to end up there.
All right. Talk to y'all on Tuesday night. Till then.
You must love hoops if you're enjoying another great episode of Dunked On. The Locked On Podcast Network has more hoops for you. Locked On has a podcast on every NBA team. If you're a Lakers fan, a Bucks fan, a Celtics fan, or a Mavericks fan, the Locked On Podcast Network has a daily podcast on your favorite team. All 30 NBA teams have a daily podcast at Locked On. Search on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.